And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 29th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the climate hawk and author, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. How are you?
That's great. Great. We're also joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
That's good. That's good. Well, the down in Washington, D.C., the creatures of the swamp are stomping around still. Some of them have nice low-rent apartments. Some of them have secret sound booths in their offices, all kinds of stuff. But they remain swamp monsters, and they are committed to bad things. Anyway, Mr. Scott Pruitt this past week has continued to come up in the news as a bad actor on many fronts. He looks worse and worse. But one of the things that he has been doing is a policy question. He's been working on a policy question for the way the EPA runs, which is by far, his damage to the EPA is by far worse than any real estate scandal he might have done. But he has been working on an idea to change the way science is done at the EPA. That is to say that the EPA, the kind of data, the very nature of the data that scientists at the EPA can use, he wants to change. So I was going to ask Mariah, can you explain what a particular piece of devilry Mr. Scott Pruitt has gone on this week with?
Yes, right. I mean, he's got a pocket full of fancy tricks, but this is definitely the worst. Are up there anyways. He is. So the EPA for decades has relied on scientific research that's rooted in confidential medical records, right? From, you know, if you're trying to figure out if a community is being polluted to the point where people are starting to get sick, you need to collect data that show that people are getting sick. But
well, this is like, for example, the data, mercury poison of the children, right?
Right. Exactly. But all these data come from people's confidential medical records. And now what Pruitt and Lamar Smith, which is the chairman of, the House of Representatives Science Committee. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, he's a Republican that rejects mainstream climate change. He and Scott Pruitt have gotten together to say that they're not going to accept data without those, basically without those confidential medical records, the confidential medical and industry data.
They cannot accept any data that is confidential in nature about people, right? That can't be included in EPA scientific decisions, right?
Right. So they, you know, essentially they're saying, unless we can put all of the data out there for the entire, you know, public to see so that it can be transparent and reproducible, then we can't make any, you know, legislative decisions based on that. And so this transparency ruling will basically hamstring the EPA's ability to protect public health by, you know, requiring that this confidential data be released before they can start protecting public health, you know, clean air, clean water, keeping chemicals out of those things. And
most of the data that this is based on is not even necessarily stuff that the scientists can release, right? I mean, it's medical records. And so basically what it does is it prevents that data from being used to create regulation, which is exactly what Mr. Pruitt wants, right?
Right, right.
And I think the flip side, maybe you're going to say, is that if in fact there is public data, then every pseudoscientist can take it and try and make a case that the data is wrong. An example being all of the climate deniers who have taken the data from climate scientists and try to rework it and prove that the original conclusion was wrong, right? Think of the Michael Mann's hockey stick data, how everyone demanded to see the raw data, and then they went over and over that raw data to try and prove the hockey stick thing was wrong. They would do the same thing with the medical records. Don't you think, Mariah?
Yeah, well, and you know, absolutely, and I think that it's also important to point out that it's not just the EPA that uses studies like this to develop policy and regulations. Former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said that other government agencies use similar sort of confidential studies to develop policy and regulations, and they are essential to making sound public policy. She said these things, this is it's important to be able to have to use records that are confidential, but then to interpret them, have professionals, have, you know, people who know what they're doing, look at the data and interpret it in a way that makes sense to protect public health.
Well, I think
So
that
citizen scientists are not going to be able to look at the data and figure it out the way that the professionals are, right? I mean,
and I guess it maybe Dia, I don't know if you saw it, but the impression that I got was that the announcement of this great transparency policy change that Swamp Monster Pruitt did was basically something that was in a press conference that was closed to the press, right? Isn't that the
yes.
case?
Yes, there was a report, I think, on Think Progress that basically, the press was shut out, but various climate denier hack types were allowed to sort of show up and partay. So it basically goes to show you that Trump's not the only one in the administration with absolute contempt for the press.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess the administrator of the EPA continues to have these egregious public, banal, venal scandals about whose house he got to live in and what baseball team he owned and things like that. The question is, why hasn't our president done the right thing and fired the guy,
Yeah, I
Mariah?
mean, yes, right.
Why is this guy still allowed to stomp around in the swamp?
I mean, I know we did a podcast a couple of weeks ago, right after the story broke about the $50 a night apartment suite gig from an energy lobbyist that, you know, Pruitt has been availing himself of. And we didn't think that it was going to last. He was going to last through the weekend, but he's stuck around. And I mean, the only thing I can think is that Trump's keeping him on because he successfully gets all of these things that are bit by bit dismantling the EPA. He gets them through. You know, I know Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that they I think in a press conference on Monday that they're a pre, you know, that Pruitt's been doing a really good job. They really appreciate all of the things that he's been doing, but it was the first time where they sort of said, well, now we're kind of monitoring some of the other things that he's doing. She called it the other things. So they've got their eyes on him, but you know, he's
Well,
pushing through agenda that they want pushed through.
that
So
raises the question, though, of what just how effective he's been. So, I mean, I've seen stuff that says his legal attempts, procedural attempts to roll back regulations have not been so successful. While these kind of policies that he can change in the within the EPA and demoralization of the EPA staff, he's been quite effective at. But tell me, DR, do you think that Scott Pruitt has succeeded, or will succeed, in actually changing these thoughtful regulations that took President Obama 6 years to get into place?
There's a lot of expectation that these efforts by Pruitt will be tied up in court, and that the courts will basically say that you can't do this because it's running afoul of the Administrative Procedures Act. It's arbitrary decision making. But you do get the sense that part of the reason why Pruitt is still around is because Pruitt is really, really good at basically, placating Trump's ego and massaging Trump's ego, and basically being the biggest cheerleader for Trump in that administration.
Well,
I mean, almost on. I mean, I was going to compare it to Anthony Scaramucci. Obviously, Scaramucci got into some problems, but he's a less vulgar version of Anthony Scaramucci, basically.
well, and I think there's, you know, if Trump pushes Pruitt along because of ethical violations, it there's this, you know, some people would say that Trump's in kind of the same boat, and so, you know, he doesn't want to say, oh yeah, this we should get him out because of ethical reasons, because Trump's got a lot of ethical issues going on himself.
Well, so let me give you a different reason why Scott Pruitt is still there, and it's based on the article that was in the New York Times on Sunday. I don't know if you read that, but it sounds as if Pruitt is a arrogant guy who thinks he's entitled to all of this, right? That's the subtext of the article. It's that, you know, this is his right and don't get in his way. And just thinking of our president holding hands with Emmanuel Macron, and as I was saying before, basically grooming him, cleaning his suit off, all this stuff. It's like the alpha male showing deference to the younger, challenging alpha male, right? Which would be Macron to Trump's old guerrilla routine. But I can imagine that Trump, who can't fire anybody, he couldn't fire Shulkin from the VA, right? He couldn't say, you're fired in person. He had to have the chief of staff go do it. I bet Trump is scared of Scott Pruitt and won't face up to him because Scott Pruitt's too arrogant a guy. And just, I mean, Scott Pruitt went behind the back, the metaphorical back of the White House to hire his two friends and pay them right after the White House said, don't give a pay raise to those two people. He went and found a way to do it. Really? And he still has a job? I mean, I think Trump's a scaredy cat when it comes right down for all of his bully stuff. I think he's a, well, there you go. Anyway, there's that story. So Scott Pruitt, I hope you're gone by the next time we meet. Right, Mariah? That's what I'm hoping for that, but boy.
Except for what? Who? Maybe they'll put in somebody worse. I don't know how you can do much worse.
Yeah.
But
well, I saw someone. They said they could get any hack to do the sort of job that Scott Pruitt's doing, right? Just go in and reject everything. And if they got one that didn't have these venal qualities of wanting to have the bulletproof tires on his SUV and the siren going to take him to the restaurant, they might last longer. Okay, Scott Pruitt, we'll put him down for a minute. So here's the other big nugget. Now, this is one we're not going to resolve in this conversation, but I wanted to put it out there because it's an interesting question. We all know that as a country, the United States needs to push to get to green energy, clean energy, as rapidly as possible. And that's fine, but then that requirement practically, in practical terms, all of a sudden becomes a plan, right? And the plan then can be criticized. Take, for example, the state of New Jersey. So there's an article by Dave Roberts in Vox about the state of New Jersey, which has made the following decision. The state of New Jersey has committed to green energy by 2030, right? Some large fraction of its energy by 2030 or 2035. An aggressive stance. God bless them. Now that Chris Christie has moved on to being a commentator for ESPN or appearing occasionally on Sunday morning TV shows, they've got a real governor in there now, and he is pushing this aggressive green agenda. But the question comes this way, that in round terms, 30% of New Jersey's power comes from nuclear plants, right, which are ostensibly green, right? There's no explicit carbon pollution that comes from running the nuclear plant, right? Maybe there's some embedded carbon, but and there's a whole bunch of gas and coal plants. And so the way I understand the logic of the New Jersey decision was that to subsidize the nuclear plants to keep them running so that over time, as wind and solar came online, it would replace the gas-powered and coal plants instead of replacing the nuclear plants, which when you look at it, say, yeah, okay, that makes sense, because why should you shut down a source that has no, the nuclear power source, which has no carbon emissions, and then try and build solar panels to replace it? At the end of the day, you replace a nuclear plant, but you have as many coal power plants. Did either of you guys see that article? I mean, did I explain that kind of conundrum clearly enough? I mean, DR, did you get a chance to think about that at all? What's your take on whether or not we should be supporting nuclear power plants?
Yes, it was a fascinating piece by David Roberts, and there have been some other pieces basically with pointing to the thought process being, as you point out, that as wind and solar scale up, eventually these nuclear plants that are receiving subsidies will be able to be retired. But if you essentially shut down the nuclear power plants now, essentially that will set up a situation where, because there's still going to be a lot of demand for energy, that demand will be replaced by either oil or coal or some other dirtier energy source. And even though the articles don't tend to cite the person I'm about to cite, I think this thought process that nuclear subsidies for existing nuclear power plants have to remain in place at least for a time until wind and solar scale up, This appears to emanate from the argument that James Hansen's been making for the past 5 years, in the midst of other climate scientists making this argument that the only way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while at the same time, you know, satisfying Americans' hunger for as much energy as possible is to subsidize existing nuclear power plants. It is a fascinating philosophical debate, right. And it's certainly one that's bound to continue for the very near future.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not at all clear to me that I don't think we should certainly be building new power plants, right? Mm-hmm. But it is a question that sort of tears at environmentalists, because the tacit acceptance of a nuclear power plant implies that you're going to accept the risk of a breakdown, of a meltdown, and the risk of the waste. But at the same time, you know, it seems craziness to shut it down and replace that with solar panels all the while the gas plant's running. I mean, Ryan, you may not have had a chance to catch up with all of this, but what do you think? What do you see?
No, yeah, I mean, I've looked into Mark Jacobson is a big, he's a professor at Stanford, energy and environmental engineering professor at Stanford, and he talks a lot about how we don't need, the big key point here is we don't need new nuclear energy. And James Hansen is sort of more on the point that we do need new, mm-hmm. new nuclear mm-hmm. energy. And I think it makes sense to me that going with nuclear energy over fossil fuels, over natural gas, for sure, if it's existing, is the way to go. I think the bigger challenge with nuclear energy over renewable is that you can't scale up nuclear energy as fast as you can scale up renewable energy, because that it takes a long time to plan and to get something, to get a nuclear plant online. And so that's the real reason that Jacobson says new nuclear is not going to get us there. It just takes too long to build a safe nuclear plant, and renewable energy, we can scale up quickly.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think New Jersey's definitely has the right idea in choosing to use their existing nuclear over fossil fuels and over natural gas, because there's, you know, much less embedded carbon, right, mm-hmm. in the nuclear. But I do hope that part of their plan is to phase out by 2050, phase out the nuclear and to have 100% renewable, ideally. I mean, maybe not 100, but.
Well, no, I guess the counterpoint, the interesting counterpoint, though, was in the Boston Globe this Sunday morning, where the people, the communities that live near the Pilgrim Power Plant. So we've talked about the Pilgrim Plant here in Massachusetts, which is slated to be shut down next year. Right? But there are waste caskets, dry waste of radioactive waste, and they're only 25 feet above the sea level. And just a couple months ago, we had a 15-foot high tide, right? And so these radioactive waste piles are at risk from sea level rise. So for me, it's like, I think that I agree kind of with the New Jersey decision, but I don't want to live near that power plant. So what about all the poor people that you're now going to ask to live near a nuclear power plant for the next, 50 years or something? I mean, really, there's so many aspects of the question. From a top level, you say, okay, this is an ugly, ugly choice. You have to do it. I mean, it's sort of, maybe the analogy is to, you know, making laws and sausages, right? That you don't want to watch a sausage be made, right? There are these terrible choices. And I agree with you, Mariah, completely. I mean, there should be no new construction of any new power plants, new nuclear power plants, right? It just, doesn't make any sense at all. Question is, well, how long to keep the old ones going?
Yeah. Well, if we had buckets of money being poured into innovation and R&D for renewable, yes, that would certainly help us transition towards safer energy more quickly.
So we don't. So I just wanted to throw this last one out there, because by the time we get, by the time next week rolls around, we'll have new outrages to discuss. So if the news goes so fast, but I just want to say in passing, ask you guys if you saw anything. The following fact slash idea: the Volkswagen Corporation, you remember, was cheating on their emissions reports. Right? This was a big scandal a couple of years ago. Volkswagen was sued by the United States government, I think in the person of the Obama administration, right? The Obama guy sued VW for lying about their miles per gallon numbers. And what came out of that was a cash settlement to the United States, all to the in each state in the United States gets some portion of the VW cash settlement from their scandal. Turns out Massachusetts gets $75 million in cash from the VW scandal money. And there's a proposal saying that we should be putting that $75 million here in Massachusetts into buying electric buses. Right? Mm-hmm. And that electric buses are the wave of the future. I mean, have either of you guys seen any of that? Maybe I'm the only one following this level of detail. But buying electric buses would really be good from a pollution standpoint. And it ties into the need for Massachusetts to come to terms with the greenhouse gas emissions of the transportation sector. Right, all those cars and stuff going around. So anyway, maybe we can come back and talk about it in a future episode. But it's a really interesting question of where's that $75 million of energy that's slated for green kind of things that comes from the Volkswagen Corporation, how are we going to spend it? Right? So, dear listener, please hang on the edge of your seat until we can come back to that topic in some future episode, because it's a good one. Anyway, we should stop. Right, guys? We've already overrun our patience. We can check out the links. We'll put up links to most of the stuff we talked about at the blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook. It's /massclimateaction. And, of course, you can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn, Podbean, SoundCloud, yada, yada, yada. I'm sure you have your own favorite. I believe we're on... what's the one? Google Play, right? We're everywhere. Mm-hmm. So we will close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here, Mariah.
Thank you.
Thanks to all you guys for listening. Love to have you along. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.